I think that Schneerson or Schmearson, I forget, he, at one point they were touting him as the Messiah, but now it's whether they're waiting for the Messiah or whether they think collectively they're their own Messiah. And, you know, the whole group are a very odd-looking bunch. I mean, even if you look at someone like the Pope now, I mean, if you just look at the guy's face, he just reminds me. And, yeah, this isn't a childish remark. I mean, he really looks like the Emperor out of Return of the Jedi. He's got a really evil-looking face.
He's got these glossy eyes like he's on some sort of mind-control drug or that he's on some sort of amphetamine or some kind of drug. And he's got these really, piercing, bulging, weird eyes, and yeah. But then you look at these Lubavitch guys, they've got curly locks with bizarre hats on them. It's like they're a throwback somewhere to a centuries ago, but then they're walking around in black suits. I remember living in New York, these people would be walking around in 100-degree heat, fully dressed in black outfits with black overcoats and black everything. And all I could say to myself is, anybody who does something like that has a screw loose.
Well, yeah, exactly. And I mean, it's sort of, that's the reason I mentioned this. Sometimes people have got to go back to basics and say, look, something just doesn't look right here, and get away from all this political correct nonsense about, we have a perfect right to do this, that, and the other. And so if someone chooses to dress like this or things or whatever, you accept them, and that's their faith, etc., etc. It is very bizarre. It's a bizarre way of acting. It's a bizarre way of dressing.
But right now in France, they're going to make it illegal for a modest Arab woman who wants to be modest. I mean, you know, there is a long-standing cultural norm in Islam that other men are not supposed to see the wives or women of another man unless they're invited to within their home. Because it's immodest, and men are not supposed to see them unless invited to. So this is a cultural norm that has traversed many, many centuries. Now I find that to be quite strange in its own right. However, now they're going to make it illegal in France. Why aren't they making it illegal for these Lubavitch to walk around in these clown outfits?
Well, you see, this is exactly the point. I mean, the reason political correctness, I believe, was brought in was basically, well, a couple of reasons. And I got into a bit of hot water on this with Aisha on CII, I think the last show that we did, because I made the comment that I thought that it was wrong, that, you know, I mean, you could have situations whereby, for example, you're in France now because you're with your wife in France, and I had a girlfriend who moved over from Germany and I lived with for a while and stuff like that. You meet, you fall in love, these things happen. But actually trying to encourage a whole group of people to come over to a country, I mean, a few years ago we had the NHS, the National Health Service in England, were going out to the Philippines to recruit all their nurses because they couldn't get enough nurses here. Well, they could get more nurses here if they paid them better, gave them better standard of living, but they didn't want to do that. So rather than do that here, they took all the nurses out of the Philippines, which will affect the healthcare in the Philippines. But they don't care about that. And this is my point. What they want to do is they want world government. So if they can bring immigration into all different countries around the world, they can say, well, what is English today? You can have a guy that's born from African heritage and he's born in England, so he's English, or of Indian heritage, born in England, so he's English. I have no gripes with anybody apart from criminals. And at the end of the day, they bring these people over, they always encourage a little bit of an undercurrent of racism through little sort of things that they'll put in their press, you know, little write-ups, commentaries and what have you, so that they keep that racism just there, whilst at the same time condemning it and saying everybody should be politically correct. And that's because they're building up to the time when they take control and people start saying, isn't it a bit strange that all these people in these high positions are of Jewish extraction and of a Zionist bent? And they'll say, well, what do you mean? You know, we're all the same. We all bleed red blood and, you know, things like that. And that's what I think it's all led to.
Well, that's right, and they've set up a system where to even make a probing question becomes racist in the
yeah.
view of. And I mean, it's really offensive, and you can see people recoil from you when they're deeply when they've got this brainwashing deeply ingrained in them, they'll move back almost like it's painful for them to hear anybody make a charge that these people might be acting criminally.
Well, it's funny you say that because in recent years, and you know, I've socialised a fair bit and what have you, and when I moved back to London and my relationship with my girlfriend ended, I came back over here. I was sort of going out, meeting different people and stuff, and everything would go well. And I'd sort of bring up the book to try and make conversation and try, because back then I wanted to wake people up and I was go ahead and what have you. Really had the fire in my belly for it. And 9 times out of 10, they just run the other way because they're like, oh no, but you're saying it's these Jews. I said, no, I'm saying Zionists. I'm saying it's a group within there. But just the fact that you can identify that the Zionist element is predominantly from this group, as we know, they have their agents like the Bushes and what have you, who might link back to this group anyway.
They do. Yes.
Exactly. You know, Harriman and all that sort of side. But as soon as you identify a group and you put any sort of race to it, then women especially run an absolute mile because they've been really... because they've been dragged into the feminist angle, which is also flawed.
Oh, but wait, but hold on now. If you want to sit there and write a book about how the Muslims are terrible and horrible, and how they're involved in all of these crimes, and it's they that did all these horrible things that we're facing in the world, everybody just sits there and says, oh yeah, okay. And there's no recoiling. In other words, they have instilled upon everyone a fear. And I think it's based in fear that to say that it might bring the ire and anger of the mass on them, and they don't want to be identified as an anti-Semite. And isn't it interesting that these people are Eastern European Khazars, not even Semitic?
Well, absolutely, and it's good that you brought that point up about the Muslim side of things, because what you'll find is that they'll say that Osama bin Laden is a radical Muslim, but at the same time, in the mainstream press in Britain, like the Daily Mail and what have you, which is, you know, sort of centre-right or maybe just right wing in its approach, they'll still report things, oh, and the Quran says that all non-Muslims need to die and things like that. But they'll never report on what the Talmud says. And so what they're doing is these attacks, you know, obviously 9/11, we had the one in London, in Madrid and all that. They'll sort of say radical Islamic group, but then at the same time, they'll always sort of say, oh yeah, but, you know, there are elements of their Quran that hate any non-Muslims and stuff. And so again, they're fomenting this division amongst the communities that they themselves created, getting behind the immigration.
And that is not what, but see, that is not what the Quran teaches either. It teaches, and it's interesting here, you know, this group, this Lubavitch group, as it, they're opening up, I think, between 20 and 30 separate centers per year in the United States alone, new cities. And they're just expanding worldwide in the thousands of centers, of Lubavitch centers. This is going to be our de facto government control at some point, in my view, once these people emerge from their power base, if they ever are allowed to get that far. You're going to see the power emanating from the Lubavitch's centers out to the politicians that they've already, put into power. And, you know, there's governors and there's senators and there's congressmen and there's tradesmen and generals, and you can see pictures of these Lubavitch with everybody. Now, one of the things that's interesting about this Zionist side of Judaism, and many people say it's satanic. I don't know that to be true or not true. In fact, I know the things they do seem satanic to me, so I can't discount the idea that it might be. But I also believe that there are other Jewish groups that hold on to their validity of the Lubavitch or the Lubavitch as the pure play religious people. But in fact, if you remember that meatpacking plant in the Midwest, Trust in America was run by Lubavitch, and it was poisoning, they were selling sickly poisoned meats as kosher to the Jewish community itself. So in other words, these people have no problem with even sickening their own community at times. No, they're just immoral in every regard. This is the same place that was producing methamphetamine on the premises, and they whitewashed over the fact that that was going on the premises and blamed some poor Mexican guy for doing it, rather than the fact that it was being done by the Lubavitch and then sold to the Midwestern methamphetamine addicts everywhere. So, you know, you can't make this stuff up.
Well, absolutely, and I mean, there are always several reasons. They never do things for just one reason, but in my opinion, this was the primary reason. If we look back at World War One, you had the Balfour Declaration, Dear Lord Rothschild, I mean, that says it all. And the fact of that was, it was the, basically, the Americans were brought into the war, providing that, you know, Britain would recognise further Jewish settlements in Israel. Unfortunately, as Eustace Mullins said several times on your show, and I've had the pleasure of speaking to Eustace a couple of times at length. I understand he's not very well now, and he's been moved to a nursing home. That was last I heard.
Yeah, in Texas, yeah.
Yeah, that was about a year ago. I was in touch with someone who knows him. But anyway, he made the comment as well that whilst they got their, you know, it was granted through the Balfour Declaration they could have more communities and bring more Jews over to Israel. Unfortunately, these Jews were quite happy in there, because Jews tend to migrate around cities. You don't really find them living in farmlands and things like that. They're more city dweller type of people. And so they went to cities like Berlin and London and what have you, and they didn't fancy just moving to a desert that was developing. And then so what do you have? You have the Second World War, in which Hitler, where there's so much evidence that he had Jewish blood himself, was basically saying, right, at the start, all Jews could leave with all their possessions and go over to Israel. And then, when that didn't work, Jews were rounded up. And, so
no, well, that's not exactly the history that I know, Andrew. I'm going to let you know. In 1933, with the transfer agreement, the German Jews left en masse if they were Zionists, and they brought boatload after boatload. But the Germans were also told that the people who were fighting the Zionists for, and this is at the time where German Jews were either lining up for or against this whole experiment in Palestine, and a lot of these German Jews did not want to immigrate anywhere, even in spite of the pressures being put on them intentionally to go, and so they were seen as opposition to Zionism. They were seen as getting in the way of Zionism, and they were sent to work camps for their opposition.
Well, this is the point I'm getting to, Darryl.
Yeah.
As you say, the Zionists flocked there en masse originally, but the Zionists that flocked there en masse were the Zionists with all the money and what have you. And if these people are going over with all the money, well, they don't want to go out and build the houses and build the highways and what have you. They need others to do that. And so it was the less affluent Jews that were rounded up to frighten them into going over there to becoming the population to build the country for the wealthy Zionists that were there. You see, this is precisely my point. It's all well and good saying, right, allow us to, when the Balfour Declaration was signed, say, allow us to have more communities and what have you in Israel. Well, okay, you can have more communities, but if you can't get people to come there, you can be a Rothschild family, you can own your own, you know, country and what have you. I think Paul McCartney has his own island somewhere. But just because you own a country or an island, unless you've got people living there, building an infrastructure, building the roads, building the houses, farming the fields, what have you, then you haven't got a country. You can have all the money in the world, but you'd just be looking out of your house with your servants onto, you know, hundreds of mile desert. And so the point was, certainly the way that I see it, was that basically they wanted to frighten Jews into settling into Israel, and that was an element of the Second World War.
Well, and then the ones that flatly refused were just shipped out and sent to work camps.
Yeah, because I think absolutely, and that's the way that it's certainly an understanding of it, because you look at the facts afterwards. You look at with Russia, with the fall of the Berlin Wall, and all these Russian Jews were suddenly brought into Israel. And you have millions coming over from Russia, when before it was very difficult to leave Russia. It was a communist country, and funnily enough, I knew a girl from East Germany for a while who, she came over to England, and last I heard she was living in England. And when she was younger, she could only travel to China or Cuba, presumably North Korea, because you were only able to fly out of Russia. Sorry, out of East Germany she was in, you could only fly to another communist country. You weren't actually allowed to fly as a citizen to, say, America or England, because then you might not come back.
Well, you know, there's a picture here about halfway down the page of the newly dedicated Chabad Center in Shanghai, China.
Oh, that's interesting.
It is indeed, and I've known for a very long time that Jewish money and Jewish power were behind Mao Zedong. They were also behind Chiang Kai-shek for a while, and when the rug was pulled out from Chiang Kai-shek, he was sent over to Formosa to become Taiwan, and Mao was running the other side of the communist side of this, which is a Jewish conspiracy, very closely related to the Jewish control of Russia, and so basically there's always been a hierarchy of Jewish control in China.
Well, yes, and you know, it's as we know, the Rothschild Bank, so-called first non-Chinese bank to go into China, but of course communism, we know, is very much linked with Zionism. And, of course, Mao Zedong we had with communism over there, and they provided for very many years, long before this bank was set up, I think only a year or two ago, that they were providing all the cheap labour to make all the clothes and toys and what have you, all your sort of designer labels are now made out there, and they're just, I think, the what you pay for them, 90% of it you're paying marketing, and only 10% for the work that's gone into it, the material that's gone to make it. And so that was very useful for them, because not only did they get the goods cheap so they could make more money on it by just touting it as some amazing design label that, you know, you have to be only really trendy and upmarket people wear, but they also were able to close down the factories or whatever that were making them in America, and then get rid of loads of jobs out there as well, so destabilise that economy.
That's exactly right.
And it's the same thing over here. I mean, what this group have done is that they've concentrated areas of production at different areas of the world, and this is all the lead up to world government. It's like, okay, we can get all our clothing made in China now, and it's very difficult to get it made in England or made in America. And that's by design, because in the end, they want to turn around and say, well, we are a global network now. We don't need people to be self-sufficient. I mean, what I would say to people that are really looking for a savior, if you like, and they look at someone like Putin or Ahmadinejad or that guy over in Venezuela, Chavez.
Yes, yes. He's a bought and paid for shill as well.
Exactly, they go against this group, and so these are the ones that we support. You will never find anybody, if you really wanted to get away from this group, and it's a very difficult thing to do, but you need to get a group of you together and say, right, I'm going to make, we'll get this lot of us are going to make clothes, this lot of us are going to sort out food, and, you know, get all your needs catered for within a small community of you.
That's right.
And then if that works, then other people will follow. And that's the only way that you'll break away from this control, because they've got everybody dependent on it. I mean, I was at the gym only earlier today, and I was hearing some people talking, and one of them was, I didn't know them, but they were sort of making some comment. I think one of them worked as a builder or something, and he was having a real go at the fact that a Tesco was going to set up in a place called Banstead, which is near where I live. And he said the trouble with all these places, they shouldn't allow them to set up in high streets or what you would call downtown. He said, because it closes everyone else up. They need to set up further away, because in the end, all you're going to have is them, and there'll be no one else left. He said, you go out these days, you go to an electrical shop to buy a washing machine, and then you go on the internet and you can find the washing machine on Tesco, so they'll deliver to you for a fraction of the price. He said, so it's all well and good people going and doing that, but they're going to kill all the competition. In the end, it's only going to be them left. And once they're the only ones left, then they'll be able to charge what they want.
Well, that's almost where we are now. And you know, you've heard me talk about Veolia being in control of water and transport and everything. They're buying up infrastructure. They're buying up government services. They're buying up all of the computer companies and all of the drug companies and all of the manufacturing base. And in other words, very soon, and we're not far from that point now, there is not going to be anything outside their control that has any import. And even all the way down by regulation to the private manufacturer of food, to make food on your own land, and then, you know, now I can't even raise an animal in the way I want to on my property without filling it full of poisonous chemicals before I'm allowed to keep it. If I have a sheep or a cow, I'm not allowed to have that thing in its natural state. I got to put all these sickening putrid chemicals in that animal, and then I'm going to have this thing for consumption after.
Well, exactly, and I mean, the point being, with this individual, I mean, if I'd have sort of turned around to him and started talking about my book and things like that, there's a way of going about it, and the mistake I've always made is that someone was quite accurate. I've got the Amazon reviews on my site, I've got a link to them, and so it links to all of them, good and bad, and someone actually said that the book was written like an onslaught. It hits you like a train because it's like one fact after another. It's not really written. It's just like someone said it was like a police record as opposed to a book, which I think is an accurate statement because mm-hmm. I'm not really an author.
Yep.
I just got the facts. I found out the bits about them, slot it in there, right, next one, and, you know, next year and stuff like that. And I'm pleased with that because it just is like a dossier that just blasts you. And if people are interested in a certain element, I hope that someone would
look go further. That's right, because it can be a jumping off point for a whole new set of information.
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole idea behind it. You look at it's 300 pages, and it's got, I haven't counted how many different events it records, but there's hundreds, if not thousands, of different events in there it records. But I've got two paragraphs on USS Liberty.
Yes.
Now, if that could encourage someone to watch some of the documentaries that are up online or read the excellent James Ennis book, and I know you've had him on your show a couple of times, you know, then people get to learn more about these certain elements. And whereas then you look at that guy that was attacking you, whose name escapes me now, he wrote a book about Einstein.
Oh, yeah, Jerky Knees.
Yeah, that's it. Oh, Jerkness, yeah. Anyway, what's that book? 2,700 pages long. I mean, who is going to go and read a book that's that long?
Well, that's
another element of, like, if you throw something that big at someone, people don't have the time, and so you have to cater for an audience. And write, I mean, I didn't want to use long words or something. I wanted this to be like a paperback book that someone could buy at an airport and read on a holiday and learn something. And so anyone could buy it at any sort of educational level. As long as they could read, they'd be fine. And that was the idea behind it. But you get people like that, and that's another element of how disinformation works. If you put something together that's just so cumbersome, then people aren't going to find out the facts if you don't introduce them.
Well, you know, we've reached the end of our hour, but you know something, Andrew, what I want to do here with you, similar to what we did with your book, going through it, you know, piece by piece, I'm going to ask you to look into the Shabbat Lubavitch's actual structure and all the things you can find on him. To put your extensive research skills into looking at the Lubavitch from your unique way of doing it, and maybe you may mail me that some of that information. What we'll do is not only will we post it, but we'll get it on air and talk about the details of how many centers they have worldwide, how many people are involved in this movement, who are some of the largest movers and shakers. I can already tell you the rabbi sitting with George Bush was also seen with many other large names, big-named politicians. And so who are the people in this, and what are the connection to these elite criminals? You know, maybe we can suss some of this out in a more in-depth way now that we've broached the subject once again. This is not the first or the fifth time I've gone over this subject, but you know, we are now looking at it from a point where we know a lot more about these crimes they've committed and the criminals that did it. So the point is that maybe we can look at it anew and bring some new perspective to the Lubavitch's real evil intent.
Well, absolutely. I mean, that would be a task, but because I haven't really been I still put stories up on the site when I changed that at the end of last year and changed the shape of it so people can go there and click on links. But I've not actually really done my own extensive research, if you like. I depended on some skills I developed when I was sort of doing the research for the book. I knew where to look for the White House photos, for example, of the kosherization of the kitchen last year, and I assumed that they'd be up there, and they were. So, yeah, that would be good, and it'd be good to sort of get back into that and see what I can find out on a sort of concentrated subject rather than trying to look at what this group have been up to over the last 250 years.
Well, I would appreciate it, and I think the listeners would be well informed from the discussion. So that'll bring us to the end of our hour. I hope you've enjoyed it. It's been an interesting hour for me, Andrew.
Yeah, absolutely. It's good to do this again. It's been a few months, and you know, it's always like a conversation between us, and it's always good fun to you know, learn from each other and hopefully give something to the audience so they can take away and they can do their own research and they can be putting things out there on, you know, primarily your two primary guests now, Mohammed and Noel, and they both do excellent work, and you know, Noel's got his Info Underground up there. And so you've given them instructions as to how to apply for membership of that, and if they believe that they have something valid to add to the research that we're doing, then that's an ideal point for them to post their information, I would say.
Well, you know, the other thing I want to do before I call this a broadcast is thank everybody who has come to my aid over the last few days to try and ameliorate some of the bills that I've collected. You know, every couple of months, I don't make the point that I need help here, you know, very often. And so when I did, there were people who have helped me to put together some money for my phone bills. I have another interview coming up. I think it's Friday with Adrian Salvucci down in Argentina, and I've got another one coming up on the weekend. I believe it's going to come out of where is this one going to be? I think this one's coming from Montreal, and I do have a phone system that gives me a discount to Montreal, but. But my point is that people did help, and I'm grateful for that, and I want everyone to know that you know, I am not a rich guy over here. I have a nice place to be because it's countryside, but my house is it's no palace. You've been here, Andrew. My house is not a palace.
It's not a palace, but it's a lovely. Lovely place to be, and it was a nice house, and you know, it was lovely to be out in the countryside there, and I appreciate why you like it so much. But I would encourage listeners as well that if you can find anybody out there that gives the information that Daryl gives, you know, please let us know, because I'd listen to them too. But I've been involved in this for many years now, and I've never found anybody better than Daryl, and it's always been an honor for me that Daryl and I got so close and did so much work. And I mean, when you look at the interviews that we did on the Synagogue of Satan, when we broke it down, and, you know, we've got about 15 hours that go through the whole book, and
yep.
That was a great deal of effort that Daryl made, and it was hard on both of us, because we take a 30-page section, and we would read it before we did it, so we had an idea of what we were going to talk about, so it was almost like an audio book of the book.
Well, that's right.
All this work is done because we just want to wake people up to defeat this group.
All we
ask is for your help, however you can give it. If you can give donations to Dow to keep him up and running, he's got his phone bills, he's got his website to run. I don't accept donations, so if you want to donate to me, donate to Dow. And the other thing is, if there is, as I say, information that you can do your own research and bring out useful information, then that's also welcome.
And send it on to me. I love new puzzle pieces to come together, and I always put them into my base of knowledge, and I'm able to make new suppositions when I'm able to get the current information from people. So please, all of the information you come across that you think is pertinent to the fight, send it on to me, and I will read it. I don't answer every email I get. I get a lot of emails, and some of them automatically go into my spam box, and I get hundreds of these a day. On some days, it's even more than that. So I don't answer every single one, but if it's about research information, I read it. And so there's several hours a day spent just reading correspondences people have sent to me, and I often have a couple of words for you. Thanks a lot for sending it, is there any more that you've got for me? So I do appreciate everything, and Andrew, I appreciate you coming on today.
Well, thank you, Darren. I point out to the listeners that that's how we started out, when shortly after you started out, and I emailed you my first Rothschild timeline.
That's right. Exactly right.
We went from there together, and it just goes to show, I think we've got 20,000 copies out there. It's up there for free on the site to read. So people can read it there. I've only got a couple of copies left now, actually. So if people are after a signed copy, they just need to email me off the site, andrewcarringtonhitchcock.com. And I apologise if I have to email you back and say I haven't got any left, but that's just the way it is. Textmaster, every time he does a print, he sends me a case, which is 32. I'm now down to the last two. And he's just done the fourth printing back in February. And so it's just dependent on when he does another printing, I'll get another case, and then I'll put the link up on the site to get it again. But in the meantime, if anyone's after these last two, then please shoot me an email.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's a show for today. I want to thank everybody for tuning in today, and please continue the fight. The weather is getting warm over here in France, but you know what? So is the problem. They're all hotting up around the globe. Keep your eyes open, and keep reporting back to what you're finding so we can continue informing you. Until the next time, ladies and gentlemen, take care of your families, and please, be well. Bye-bye now.